Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're moving beyond fleeting trends and really getting into something ancient and powerful, Wichisakyant. That's the tradition of sacred tattooing in Southeast Asia. We've pulled together some fascinating sources, mapping its journey, its meaning.
Yeah, it's incredible stuff.
Our mission today, to look past just the visuals, you know, the striking designs, and really understand Sakyant as this profound spiritual practice, almost like a spiritual technology honed over centuries.
That's a great way to put it, because Sakyant, it isn't just about like applying ink to skin. It's fundamentally a ritual.
Okay.
The designs themselves, they're seen as instruments, tools of sacred power. Even the name tells you that. Sak means to tap or tattoo.
Right.
And yantra, that refers to a mystical diagram, a spiritual instrument. So right from the start, you've got this blend, physical act, deep spiritual intent.
And visually, they're just, they're something else, aren't they? Completely different from your average tattoo.
Oh, absolutely.
We're talking these intricate geometric patterns, sometimes powerful animal figures. And they're all woven together with inscriptions in these like ancient scripts.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very distinct look. But like you said, what you see is only part of the story.
Exactly. These aren't just, you know, cool designs. Every line, every symbol, it's like coded prayer or blessing. The skin becomes this living manuscript.
Wow.
And that's the core of it, really. The ritual, the consecration. These marks aren't just put there. They're brought to life through sacred chants, incantations, recited by Buddhist monks, you know, the spiritual leaders, or by trained lay masters. They call them Ajarns.
Ajarns, okay.
And it's this process, this ritual that transforms the ink into something much, much more than decoration.
And the effects people seek, they sound pretty significant. Our sources mention things like protection, attracting good luck.
Inner strength, too.
Inner strength, right. It's like carrying a spiritual shield almost.
Yeah.
But one that asks something of you in return. It seems people are drawn to it for profound reasons. What are the main drivers, would you say?
Protection is definitely a big one, no doubt. And blessings for luck, personal power, sure.
Mm-hmm.
But it's often also about, you know, a deeper connection, committing to a spiritual path. Mm-hmm. Because the power, the effectiveness of the Sakyant, it's often tied directly to the person's own conduct, their morality. There's a code, sila, which basically mirrors the ethical teachings in Buddhism.
So it's not just get the tattoo, get the magic.
Not at all. It's about embracing a certain way of living, too. It's a commitment.
Okay, let's trace this back. Where did this incredible tradition even begin? Its historical roots.
Oh, the origins are fascinating. They go way, way back, deep into indigenous animism.
Animism. So spirit beliefs.
Yeah, exactly. Beliefs in the power of animal spirits, forces of nature, that kind of thing. And then over time, you see ancient Indic yantras getting integrated.
Yantras again. Those mystical diagrams.
Right. Originally used for protection, invoking energies in Hindu traditions mostly.
So it's this mix, animism, Hinduism, Buddhism. How do they all fit together? Was it smooth sailing?
That's a really good question. I mean, they are distinct traditions, but in Sakyant, they seem to have mingled, you know, enriched each other.
Interesting.
This blending, this syncretism, it's actually key to its strength. By drawing on these different sources, it could address a whole range of human needs. Protection, prosperity, inner peace, all of it.
And the location, where do we think it really took shape?
Well, the evidence points pretty strongly towards the Khmer Empire.
Okay, Cambodia region, 9th to 15th centuries, that powerhouse.
That's the one. They had a huge influence across Southeast Asia. And during that time, we find the earliest signs of practices that look a lot like Sakyant.
Like what kind of signs?
Specifically among warriors, getting protective tattoos before heading into battle.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
And is there physical proof?
Oh, yeah. You just have to look at Angkor Wat, the carvings there from the 12th century.
Wow.
They clearly show these early yantras. It's undeniable visual proof etched in stone. Tells you this isn't some recent invention.
No kidding. 12th century. That really drives home how ancient this is.
It really does. It shows the tattooing of yantras, the designs, the symbolism, even the use of ancient Khmer script. It all started within that empire over 1,000 years ago.
And the warrior connection seems crucial.
Absolutely. The belief it offered protection, maybe even invulnerability.
Hmm.
That practical use in warfare, that likely drove its spread big time.
So it starts in the Khmer Empire. How does it then move into Siam, what's now Thailand.
Well, the earliest documented cases in Siam pop up around the 1600s, during the Ayutthaya Kingdom.
And still linked to warriors.
Still, very much so. Soldiers getting yant tattoos, even special yant shirts as talismans for battle.
And then it seems like it became more formalized over time in Siam.
Yeah, definitely. The Ayutthaya period, say 14th, 18th centuries, that was key. You had monk scholars starting to codify the designs, the rituals.
That's codifying them. Like writing them down?
Exactly. Standardizing things a bit. We even find earlier clues, like something called the Tuatho inscription linked to sacred numbers on old silver palm leaf manuscripts from the Sukhothai period. And the first explicit mention of Lekyant, the Yantra inscriptions, in actual Thai chronicles. That's 1498.
It's fascinating that tattooing itself wasn't some fringe thing back then.
Not at all. Our sources say it was pretty common among men in Thailand. Mostly for spiritual, religious reasons, a personal expression of faith.
Right.
And its popularity just kept growing, especially with soldiers, Muay Thai fighters, which, you know, eventually helped it gain the global recognition it has now. Quite a journey.
And this formalization process, it sounds like it involved the state, the monks, and the people's own beliefs.
Precisely. A real interplay. You had state interests, the Sangha, the Buddhist monastic community, and these deeply rooted folk beliefs.
How did they manage that? Integrating folk beliefs into formal Buddhism.
The monastic scholars were key. They actively worked to weave these existing indigenous traditions into the Theravada Buddhist framework, finding ways to make it fit, essentially. You even see state influence later on, like when formal education in the Khmer script was stopped after 1945. That directly impacted how parts of the tradition were passed on.
Wow. Okay. Let's shift gears now to how it's actually done, the application. It's clearly not like walking into a modern tattoo shop.
Oh, not even close.
Having explored the ancient roots, let's get into the rituals.
Yeah.
How are these symbols actually brought to life?
Right. So the application itself is a sacred ritual, totally different world from conventional tattooing.
Oh, so?
Traditionally, it's hand-poked. They use a long metal rod called a kem, or sometimes a bamboo stick with a needle attached.
Hand-poked. That sounds intense.
It is. And that choice, it's deliberate. It's not about speed like with a modern machine.
There's a deeper meaning to the method itself.
Exactly. It's seen as a test of endurance. And that connects directly to the Buddhist concept of dukkha.
Dukkha. Suffering or life's inherent unsatisfactoriness.
Right. So enduring the pain is actually seen as a form of ascetic practice. It's thought to make the recipient more spiritually receptive, and crucially, it boosts the tattoo's power.
So the pain is part of the process, part of the spiritual journey.
An integral part, yeah. It definitely forges a different kind of bond with the tattoo, you know?
I can imagine. And our sources mention a choice of tools, bamboo versus steel.
Yeah, there's often a choice. Bamboo is generally seen as less painful, maybe heals faster. Steel allows for more precision, sharper lines, but yeah, it's more painful.
Depends on the person and the master, I guess.
Pretty much. Personal preference, master's advice.
Okay, so the poking happens, then what? The really critical part seems to be the consecration.
Absolutely pivotal. This is where the magic happens, so to speak.
Okay.
Whether it's a respected monk or a trained ajarn doing it, the consecration involves chanting. Reciting sacred mantras, kathas, during the entire process.
The whole time they're tattooing.
The whole time. And it's these incantations that are believed to infuse the tattoo with its spiritual energy, its power, turning it into a living talisman.
So it's the ritual, the chanting. That's what gives it power, not just the ink and the image.
That's the core belief. Without that consecration ritual, it's just a picture on your skin. No real spiritual juice.
And the master's role isn't just tattooing, then?
No, far from it. They also play a key role in choosing the right design, the right placement. Sometimes it's described as like reading the aura.
Reading the aura.
Yeah, intuitively figuring out what that person needs, what yantra will help them most, aligning it with their intentions.
So the master acts as a kind of spiritual guide or intermediary.
Precisely. The effectiveness, the spiritual power, it really depends on the master's ritual actions and their own spiritual development. They're the conduit for that energy.
And the person receiving it, they have responsibilities too, right? Beyond just sitting there. We mentioned Sila earlier, the moral code.
Yes, absolutely fundamental. You commit to upholding a code of conduct. It's very similar to the five precepts in Buddhism.
And this is necessary to keep the tattoo's power.
That's the belief, yes. These rules, these guidelines, they're essential for maintaining the Sakyan's potency. Breaking them, things like, you know, killing, stealing, lying, sexual misconduct, intoxication is believed to weaken or even completely nullify the power.
Interesting. So the power is linked to your behavior.
Yeah.
That resonates with a lot of spiritual ideas, doesn't it? Maybe things you're familiar with too.
It really does. It makes the tattoo more than just a symbol. It's tied to your ethical life.
And there's some really specific rules too. Things that might seem unusual from the outside.
That's true. Depending on the master and the lineage, you might get prohibitions like not spitting in toilets, avoiding sex during menstruation, staying away from certain foods like zucchini or licorice.
Zucchini.
Yeah, specific things like that. Or not walking under clotheslines, not sitting on certain ceramic urns, things that show respect for purity or sacredness in different ways.
Wow.
They all reinforce this idea that maintaining the power requires mindfulness in many areas of life.
So getting a sake ant, it's a whole commitment. Physical, spiritual, ethical, all intertwined.
Exactly. It acts as both a talisman and a kind of constant moral reminder for the person wearing it.
Let's talk about the masters themselves, the guardians of this tradition. Our sources stress how vital lineage is and their spiritual abilities. It feels like the whole tradition rests on them.
It really does. The survival, the continuation of Wichisakyan, it's totally tied to the knowledge, the skill, and importantly, the spiritual power of the masters.
And these can be monks or lay people?
Both. You have ordained Buddhist monks, and you have respected lay masters, the Ajarns. Ajarns are often former monks, actually. They act as spiritual mentors, knowing both the magical practices and Buddhist principles.
Okay.
And then you also have the Ruwaizi, hermit monks, revered figures embodying wisdom gained through like intense solitary practice.
And how is this knowledge passed down?
Historically, it's been very direct. Teacher to student, personal relationships. This led to distinct lineages developing over centuries, each with its own nuances.
And the sources name some really significant figures. Can we talk about a few? Maybe Luangpho Pern of Wat Bang Phra?
Oh, definitely. Luangpho Pern is huge. He's widely credited with really boosting the popularity and awareness of Sakyant, especially more recently.
And his temple, Wat Bang Phra.
Still incredibly important. They have a massive annual festival, the Wai Kru, where people go to recharge their yants. Thousands attend. His lineage is foundational for many today.
Then there's Long Kor Lay of Wat Pra Song. His story sounds quite intense.
It really is. Apparently, a tragic event in his youth motivated him to delve deep into Sakyant. He studied under like 14 different guru masters.
14, wow.
Yeah. And he became especially famous for his 9 unique Hanumanyant formulas. Very powerful stuff.
Going further back, Luang Pu Suk of Wat Pak Klong Makum Thao.
A highly respected master. This is before World War II. Known for mystical tattooing, powerful amulets, yant shirts. Also famous for psychic powers from meditation, he even taught royalty.
And Luang Pu Thong of Wat Rakyotha. He lived an incredibly long life.
Astonishingly long. 117 years, 96 as a monk. He was known for making these supposedly invulnerable yant shirts for soldiers. They called them ghost soldiers.
Ghost soldiers.
Yeah, because they were apparently so hard to kill in battle. His longevity led many to revere him as an arahant, a fully enlightened being.
These aren't just tattoo artists, then. They're deeply respected spiritual figures. What about today? What does the scene look like now?
It's diverse. You have some masters who stick very strictly to their own lineage teachings. Others take a more eclectic approach, studying and blending different traditions.
Adapting to modern times.
Yeah, adapting pragmatically, dealing with more foreign recipients, navigating changing monastery rules. You even see some monks becoming lay ajarns because of government regulations about monks performing certain services.
Right. And the sources list quite a few contemporary masters, especially around Chiang Mai.
Yeah, it gives a real snapshot. You've got Ajarn Dang, called a master's master for his deep knowledge. Multiple Ajarn Toms, each with different specialties. Respected monks like Monk Rishon, Monk Ik, who are like fourth generation practitioners in their family.
It's the first generation.
It shows the continuity. Each one brings their own skills, keeping the tradition alive and, you know, vibrant.
And in Bangkok, Grandmaster Ajarn Pum seems like a key modern figure.
Definitely. He learned from over 70 masters. Incredible dedication.
70.
Became a master himself in 2002. Then later, he actually left monkhood, became a lay grandmaster due to family needs and those changing regulations.
But still highly respected.
Oh, absolutely. Still revered, still offers a wide range of spiritual services. He really embodies how the tradition is evolving.
Okay, let's get into the designs themselves, the iconography. It's clearly more than just art.
So much more. The visual language of Sakyant is incredibly rich. Forms, symbols, scripts, each loaded with specific meaning and purpose.
It starts with geometry, right?
Often, yes. You see these precise geometric shapes triangles, circles, hexagons, octagons, often radiating from a center, maybe framed by a square representing the four directions.
The shapes themselves have power. Sacred geometry.
That's the principle. The idea is these forms resonate with cosmic forces, divine energies. It's like a universal visual code for channeling spirituality. We can sort of group them into four main types: circular, triangular, square, and pictorial yantras. Each has its own core symbolism.
And the goals are so varied: protection, love, money.
Exactly. Whatever the need, protection, popularity, luck, wealth, general well-being, there's likely a yantra believed to help achieve it.
Let's talk specifics. Hatte, the five lines. That one's probably the most famous, right? Thanks to celebrities.
It's certainly very recognizable now. Yeah, often it's a foundational yant for people. Five vertical lines of script, usually calm. Each line carries a distinct blessing for different life areas, drawing power from the four elements. Protection, luck, charisma. It covers a lot.
Then Gao Yord, nine spires. Sounds important, like the ultimate spiritual multi-tool, offering broad protection and blessings from Buddhist principles.
You could say that. It's often called the Master Yant, or Nine Peaks. It symbolizes the nine top qualities of the Buddha and Mount Meru, the mythical cosmic mountain.
So very sacred.
Extremely. It offers a wide range of protection and blessings, you know, strength, success, avoiding harm. It's considered so potent there are even specific rules, prohibitions, just for those who receive the Gao Yord, to help maintain its power.
Okay. Paid Tit, eight directions. That name suggests protection from all sides.
Exactly. It's a distinctive circular design, traditionally believed to shield travelers, or anyone really, from negative influences coming from all eight cardinal directions. Each direction has its own specific Pali chant associated with it.
Yant Kropetch, diamond armor. Sounds like serious defense.
It really does. It's a shield-like geometric pattern. The belief is it creates this impenetrable spiritual shield against dark magic, negative energy, harmful spirits. It repels danger, even reflects bad luck back where it came from.
And Yanfrei Pita, the closed eyes Buddha, that image is quite striking.
It is. It shows a monk deep in meditation, hands over his eyes, shutting out the world. It symbolizes focusing inward, finding inner peace, being indifferent to external chaos.
What are its benefits supposed to be?
Protection from dangers, obstacles, curses, attracting good luck, opportunities, strengthening meditation, bringing peace of mind, prosperity. It's popular with people in risky jobs.
We definitely have to mention Hanuman, the monkey god.
Absolutely. From the Ramayana epic, he embodies strength, courage, loyalty, perseverance.
So the yant gives you those qualities.
That's the idea. Protection from danger and fear, boosting confidence, influence, focus, determination. Even kindness, avoiding injury, defeating enemies, gaining power, authority, loyalty, magical invincibility. Hanuman covers a lot.
Yants Weiku, twin tigers. Sounds fierce.
It represents raw power, immense strength, speed, agility. Also believed to give robust protection, authority, maha amnaj, enhanced status, serum yos, and help in business.
And Naga, the serpent creature. That seems deeper, more mystical.
Yeah, the Naga connects to power, wisdom, spiritual forces, often seen as guardians of treasures, sacred teachings, associated with water, too.
And the benefits.
Protection from negativity, attracting wealth, inspiring wisdom, intuition, fostering spiritual growth, promoting charm and popularity.
Yanesh, the Hindu elephant god, also appears.
Yes, as the Lord of Beginnings. He represents wisdom, power, removing obstacles. So blessing new projects, bringing success, knowledge, confidence, prosperity.
Yeah, Phairochasi, king of lions.
Embodies strength, courage, nobility, dominance. Believed to grant power, authority, respect, bravery, leadership, success.
The Unalame is visually quite simple but profound, isn't it? That spiral ending in a line.
It's a beautiful symbol of the path to enlightenment. The spirals are life's twists and turns. The straight line is reaching peace, harmony, enlightenment.
And its purpose.
Spiritual guidance, protection, luck, success. It's also thought to strengthen the blessings of any other Sakyant you might have.
And then there's some more. Yeah. Specific ones, like Yant Sarika, the magic bird, or Yant Jingjok, the gecko.
Right, they target different things. Sarika, the songbird, is about enchanting communication, attracting love. Good for persuasion, negotiations, charm, kindness, popularity, attracting money, too.
And the gecko.
Jingjok embodies attractiveness, kindness, good luck. Seen as auspicious for business, attracting customers, love interests. Also thought to ward off evil spirits, even before Buddhism.
Lastly, Yan Tao Ruin, the turtle house. Longevity, Stability.
Exactly. Based on Buddha's incarnation as a turtle and turtle symbolism in general, believed to bring wealth, success, luck, long life, emotional healing, perseverance, recovery, respecting boundaries, physical defense, independence. A lot packed into that turtle.
Wow. Okay, the scripts used in these designs, they're not just random letters, are they? They're key.
Absolutely central. Sakyont doesn't typically use standard modern Thai or Cambodian. It uses older, more esoteric scripts.
Primarily Kom Akara.
Old comer.
That's the main one. Derived from ancient Brahmi script from India, used widely in Cambodia centuries ago for sacred texts, so it carries immense religious weight. Using it connects directly back to that ancient heritage.
Precisely. And the script itself, often using abbreviations for longer mantras or prayers, is believed to actually channel the spiritual energy.
And the fact that most people can't read it.
That adds to the mystique, reinforces the esoteric nature, and underscores the master's authority as someone who holds this sacred knowledge.
But Kom isn't the only script found.
No, definitely not. You also frequently see Pali, that's the ancient language of Theravada Buddhism, used for prayers, mantras, invocations for power and protection.
Okay.
Then regionally, up in northern Thailand, Lana script is prominent. It came from ancient Mon script, and northern masters value it for its power and beauty, used for various local languages, plus Pali and Sanskrit.
And other regions.
In the northeast, Aizen, they use Tam Aizen script. It's fundamental for certain yants common there, like Maha Ut or Suya. And depending on the place and lineage, you might find Lao, Burmese, Mon, Tai Lu, Shan scripts too. It's really diverse.
So the different scripts show it's not just one single thing, but adapted locally.
Exactly. Kom in central Thailand, Cambodia, Lana in the north, Kam Aizen in the northeast. It highlights regional identity, local traditions within the practice.
Interesting. It suggests the power isn't just abstract, but tied to specific cultural roots.
Right. It resonates with local beliefs, ancestral knowledge, strengthens the connection between the master, the recipient, and their specific environment.
So, wrapping up this deep dive, it's crystal clear. Sakyant is incredibly deep, way more than just body modification. For you, the listener, especially if you're interested where art meets spirituality, it's a prime example.
Absolutely. It's this complex, beautiful tradition blending animism, Hinduism, Theravada Buddhism. We've seen its journey from the Khmer Empire through Siam, adapting, enduring, always retaining that core spiritual purpose.
And these intricate designs applied through ritual by dedicated masters using these ancient, powerful scripts. They're meant to be conduits, channels for protection, strength, luck, guidance.
But its growing global fame, you know, partly thanks to celebrities, brings up questions. It's a double-edged sword.
How so?
Well, it brings visibility, which can help preserve it. But there's also a real risk of, well, cultural appropriation, of the deep spiritual meaning getting watered down.
Right. Just becoming a trend.
Exactly. Which makes it so important, if you're considering getting one, to seek out a genuine, knowledgeable practitioner, a real monk or a respected Ojarn who truly understands the texts, the rituals, the ethics involved.
And it's good there are groups working to preserve it, like the Federation Khmer Sakyantra you mentioned.
Definitely encouraging. It feels like the future hinges on finding that balance, tradition versus modernity.
So here's something for you to think about. Will Sakyant manage to stay this profound spiritual path for those who truly commit? Or is it destined to become just another cool aesthetic detached from its roots? And maybe more importantly, how crucial is understanding its deep cultural history in making sure its real authenticity survives? That's something to chew on after our deep dive today.